The headlines, the UK says it can clinch a Brexit trade deal with the European Union, but London will not sign up to any accord at any cost. Israel releases Palestinian administrative detainee Maher al-Ahraz, who was on hunger strike for more than 100 days. And worldwide coronavirus cases surpass the grim milestone of 60 million with nearly 1.5 million deaths. Hello and welcome, everybody. UK's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, says his country is not willing to reach a post-Brexit trade agreement with the EU at any cost. Sunak said it's preferable to get a deal, but London absolutely will not be stretching for an accord that's not up to its standards. On Thursday, European Commission head Ursula von der Leyen said the bloc is ready for the possibility of Britain leaving the bloc without a new trade accord. The two sides have been holding negotiations for months but failed to make a breakthrough. Britain left the EU in January, nearly 4 years after a landmark Brexit referendum. A transition period is now in place until December the 31st, which serves as a deadline for their talks on future relations. Our correspondent in London, Amina Taylor, says the UK is talking tough to save face, and the fact is that Britain desperately needs a trade deal with the EU more than ever.
Rishi Sunak's statement, that was off the back of a very gloomy spending review that the Chancellor issued yesterday in the House of Commons, where essentially, thanks to COVID and other issues, Britain is now in a £400 billion hole. Right now, in looking at the whole picture for Britain's gloomy economic output, being within the bosom of the European Union might have offset some of those bumpy rides ahead. We do remember that just a couple days ago, the European Union unveiled its €1+ trillion budget, and Britain no longer gets to partake in that, despite having ponied up some €10 billion in terms of its own exit liabilities. And I think it's very easy to talk tough in these negotiations, but right now, I think the real sad state of affairs is Britain needs the European Union's trading money and access more than the European Union needs Britain right now. In order to save face, really, Britain has to be talking tough right now. But let's see, because there are still negotiations ongoing this weekend, and those will go down to the wire with both sides having to save face and to try and make it seem as if they're doing the best for their particular element. But right now, Britain, make no mistake about it, certainly has the losing hand in these negotiations.
A Palestinian prisoner who had gone on a long hunger strike has finally been released by the Israeli regime. Maher al-Ahraz had been on hunger strike for 103 days in protest at his imprisonment under Israel's so-called administrative detention policy. He stopped his hunger strike on November the 6th after Tel Aviv agreed last month to free him. Al-Ahraz then said he would spend the rest of his jail term in hospital for treatment until the day he was scheduled to be released. Israeli courts initially refused to order his release despite his deteriorating health conditions and calls by international and legal institutions to stop his administrative detention. The administrative detention is a form of imprisonment without trial or charge, allowing Israel to incarcerate Palestinians. Our correspondent Mona Kandil says Palestinian prisoner Maher al-Ahraz, who was released after more than 100 days of hunger strike, is still suffering from health conditions.
He will remain in hospital for several days because he's still suffering from the conditions he was facing due to the open-ended hunger strike. As you were saying, Israel continues to use administrative detention against Palestinians because they, in a way or another, they know that those Palestinians are activists with and affiliated with some Palestinian resistance groups. However, they don't have really accusations against them in order to force them to quit the affiliation of the Palestinian groups and not to be engaged in any form of resistance. They arrest Palestinians and hold them in Israeli jails under the illegal so-called administrative detention without charge or trial.
China says it has lodged stern representations with the United States after Washington announced fresh Iran-related sanctions on Chinese and Russian entities.
We firmly oppose unilateral sanctions on long-arm jurisdiction of other countries by the United States. We urge the U.S. to correct its mistakes and withdraw the illegal sanctions.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman further said that his country would firmly safeguard its own legitimate rights and interests. He added Beijing would continue to work hard to protect the international non-proliferation system. The reactions came a day after Washington announced imposing sanctions on four entities in China and Russia, accusing them of promoting Iran's missile program. Earlier, Iran's UN envoy, while addressing a virtual Security Council meeting, warned about the consequences of U.S. unilateral sanctions. Russia in the same session also called these measures illegal and a threat to international peace and security. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says the U.S. could never prevent the Islamic Republic from importing technology. Rouhani said sanctions have caused problems but could never hamper Iran's development and progress. He said Iran has constructive interaction in economic fields with the world. Iran has been under a series of sanctions imposed by the U.S. since 2018 when President Donald Trump withdrew Washington from the 2015 nuclear deal. Australia has reportedly issued termination notices to at least 10 special forces over a recent report on troops' unlawful killings in Afghanistan. The Australian Broadcasting Corporation says none of the 10 soldiers are among those referred in the report for possible prosecution. It has not identified the 10 soldiers, but says all of them were witnesses or accessories to the unlawful killings. Last week, a report revealed that 19 Australian Special Forces killed at least 39 unarmed Afghan prisoners and civilians between 2005 and 2016. The report sparked an outrage among the Afghan people who demanded justice for the war crimes committed. They also urged the Afghan government to conduct its own investigation. However, Canberra said last week that the crimes would be dealt with under its own justice system. And the number of coronavirus infections has crossed the 60 million mark worldwide, with total deaths standing at more than 1.4 million. According to the Johns Hopkins University tally, the United States tops the list with more than 12.7 million cases and over 260,000 fatalities. Coming second is India, where more than 9 million have been infected and over 134,000 have died. Brazil has the third highest number of cases at more than 6 million. Over 170,000 have died there. The COVID-19 pandemic continues to take its toll on countries across the world. It has prompted many states to extend or introduce new lockdowns and restrictions to tackle the spread of the disease. Daily coronavirus infections and deaths remain high in Europe as the pandemic keeps surging through the continent despite restrictive measures remaining in place. In Ukraine, daily infections hit a record high of over 15,300. That pushes the country's total to above 677,000. Nearly 12,000 people have so far died of the disease there. The Ukrainian government said on Wednesday that it was considering tightening restrictions during winter holidays if the virus surge is not contained. Russia also reported nearly 25,500 new infections, its highest daily caseload. The country has so far confirmed nearly 2.2 million infections and more than 38,000 deaths. Infections in Germany rose by over 22,000 to more than 983,000. The government says the current COVID-19 restrictions might continue into next year. Well, the European Commission unveils a strategy designed to make the 27-nation EU less dependent on imports of medical equipment and medication. The bloc has faced major shortages during the COVID-19 pandemic, especially earlier this year, due to its reliance on China for supplies. Jerome Humes reports.
The coronavirus crisis has highlighted just how vulnerable the EU is when it comes to even the most basic healthcare requirements, such as having enough face masks. The bloc has also had to import ventilators and medication, mostly from China. The European Commission has just unveiled a pharmaceutical strategy aimed at making the EU less dependent.
We do not want to see never again the problems that we faced during the first weeks of the pandemic. Never again.
The plan is to ensure essential items are manufactured within the EU. The European Commission is also concerned that EU nations will not be ready to distribute vaccines when they become available in the coming weeks. Just half of the bloc's 27 nations have published plans. Countries are being told to redouble their efforts.
This means that member states need to have the necessary infrastructure and the logistics, so when there is a safe and effective vaccine, they can roll it out and deploy it as quickly as possible.
Businesses are buckling under the pressure of lockdowns in many EU countries. The run-up to the December and January holiday period is normally their most profitable time. EU leaders continue to squabble over much-needed financial support packages for employers.
We've seen a major shock to the whole of the euro area, major trouble in Spain, in Italy, in other countries. I think the response was too weak.
Officials warn that if COVID-19 restrictions are relaxed too soon, hospitals will be overwhelmed during early 2021. It appears to be an impossible health-economy balancing act for governments. There is concern we are becoming complacent because we know vaccines are coming. Equally, authorities are worried too few of us will take advantage of the scientific breakthrough.
The European Centre for Disease Control says each year hundreds of thousands of healthcare workers in the EU refuse to take the seasonal flu vaccine. It begs the question how many of them, and how many people in general, will agree to be injected with a COVID-19 vaccine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Thousands of women have taken to the streets of big cities across Latin America to mark the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, decrying gender-based violence and discrimination. Police clashed with protesters in the Mexican capital, firing tear gas to disperse them. Some protesters also vandalized buildings and spray paint walls to show their anger over inequality and violence against women. Official data show that 6 out of every 10 women have suffered some form of violence in the country over the past decade. Hundreds of women also marched through the Colombian capital, Bogota, to voice their anger over gender-based and institutional violence. They say violence against women has increased during coronavirus lockdowns.
Every day we are living the violence, and more during this time of confinement, where the violence has become more evident in a deeper way, right? Especially towards women.
Hundreds of Bolivian women also took to the streets of the capital, La Paz. They demanded justice for victims of gender-based crimes. They also accused the current and previous governments of not doing enough to protect women from violence and femicide. Similar protests took place in other cities across the region, including in the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. The body of Diego Maradona, the Argentine legendary footballer who died on Wednesday, has arrived at the presidential palace in Buenos Aires for a public tribute. Hundreds of people gathered outside the building for hours to pay respect to Maradona. The Argentine president also declared 3 days of national mourning. Maradona died at the age of 60 at his home in the town of Tigre after suffering a cardiac arrest. He's regarded as one of the greatest players in the history of football. He scored 34 goals in 91 appearances for Argentina, representing the country in 4 World Cups. He became a household name after steering his country to the World Cup title in 1986. Football stars including Pelé, Lionel Messi, and Cristiano Ronaldo have paid tribute to the Argentine icon. Latin American expert Danny Shaw says Diego Maradona has been a representative of the struggling people of the continent during his time.
Diego Maradona, more than any other athlete of our time, perhaps you'd have to go back to a Muhammad Ali to strike this type of comparison of an athlete who truly defended the interests of the underdog. A great footballer and a great human being who came from a shanty town outside of Buenos Aires, born in 1960, to really nothing. Representative of the forgotten masses of South America, of the wretched of the earth. So in 1986, when you have the semi-final game in the World Cup between England and Argentina, the soccer pitch becomes a battlefield, or an extension of the battlefield. And that warm July day in Mexico City is when Diego Maradona, very heroically and historically, has the Mano de Dios goal, where he, in a very crafty way, taps it in using his hand, and then moments later sprints through a minefield of English defenders and scores what would become known as the goal of the century. So here we see the connection between these big macro political anti-colonial themes in this game that so many people across the oppressed countries and, of course, South America love, the game of football or soccer.
A Turkish court has handed down life sentences to dozens of defendants accused of carrying a 2016 coup attempt from an army base near the capital, Ankara. The Turkish media reported that 25 fighter jet pilots were given aggravated life imprisonment, while four civilians were sentenced to life. The trial was the most high profile among dozens of court cases concerning the coup attempt against President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Nearly 500 defendants, including army commanders, faced charges in the session. More than 250 people were killed and over 2,000 others injured during the botched putsch. Ankara accuses Fethullah Gulen, an opposition figure living in the U.S., of orchestrating the coup, but he denies the allegation. Since 2016, tens of thousands of people have been detained, and 150,000 public sector employees have been suspended over their alleged links to Gulen. Another four migrants have drowned off Spain trying to reach the shores of Europe. Dozens have been rescued, but some remain unaccounted for. The bloc is trying to prevent migrants from setting out and reaching its shores, but it seems desperation is so acute that migrants are prepared to risk dying at sea. The International Criminal Court has sued Europe, saying it allows deaths at sea as part of its deterrence-based migration policy. Bianca Raimi tells us more.
Arrivals on the Canary Islands have surged. Almost 17,000 people have reached their shores so far this year, more than 10 times last year's total, and hundreds have died trying. The Spanish government has promised to set up camps and shelters for more than 7,000 people, but overwhelmed local authorities and activists say the migrants are being treated with contempt.
The majority of migrants who are arriving are returnable, or expellable, if we may say. They are not candidates that apply to our reception system. Our reception system is tailored for vulnerable people and people who have asked for international asylum.
Over in France, images of homeless migrants camped out on a Paris square being evacuated by police have caused outcry, forcing lawmakers to comment on the situation that seems far from under control.
Was this event authorized? Was it legal? The answer is no. Should we have left on the Place de la République hundreds of tents, hundreds of people without evacuating them? The answer is no. Was I, like you or others, shocked to see some images on social media of evacuation? Proof that this is a free country? Of course.
Those who have nothing, not even a roof over their heads, sheltered themselves symbolically under the statue symbolizing the Republic to call for fundamental rights. They were peaceful. The order was given for them to be evacuated at any cost, although they did not represent any threat at all.
Immigration to Europe is fueled by wars and economic instability in which Europe is complicit. The bloc's exploitation of resources and interventionism goes on around the globe, and countries like Britain sell arms to almost all regimes deemed violators of human rights. To stop migrants setting out in the first place, millions of euros are also pumped into countries like Libya, a conduit for African migrants, and end up in the hands of militiamen, traffickers and Coast Guard members who imprison and torture thousands of migrants. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Let It Fall, LA 1982 to 1992, directed by John Ridley. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Suresh Grover, who is the director of the Monitoring Group, which is a leading anti-racist charity here in the UK that promotes civil rights. Now, Let It Fall provides an in-depth look at the racial tensions in Los Angeles in the 10 years leading up to the 92 riots, which erupted after the acquittal of four police officers charged in the brutal beating of Rodney King. The riots caused a lot of destruction in the streets of LA, which resulted in the deaths of more than 50 people, who were mostly black, injured over 2,000, and caused at least $1 billion worth of damages.
The Los Angeles police officially reprimanded Police Chief Daryl Gates.
We were having deaths from the chokehold.
He didn't get along with the community.
In the early 80s, the street gangs started to connect with the drug dealers.
It just got out of control.
Karen Tashima was killed in gang crossfire.
This is something that you always see on the news, and this time it happened to us.
We are determined to take back the streets of Los Angeles.
Operation Hammer was a free ticket to go out there and do overly aggressive police work.
What I witnessed at the scene was 100% LAPD policy.
Soon Ja Du, found guilty of killing a 16-year-old girl, received no jail time.
She got away with murder.
Black and brown people are being beat up, shot, choked to death by police forces all over this country.
We, the jury, find the defendant not guilty.
Not? You just disrespect us like this? Like our lives don't matter?
Not guilty, the verdict for all of them.
We were sort of stunned.
We need to back out of here before we have to use deadly force.
It's like pouring gasoline and striking a match. It's not protest anymore. Now it's a full-blown riot.
I was a part of a movement, a black movement. There's a Florence and Normandy in every city and every state.
It was just one of those days compassion wasn't handed out to other races.
God told me to go save them, save that man's life.
You talked about guerrilla warfare, and it's right here.
18-year-old Edward Song Lee was shot to death.
It doesn't seem real.
It felt like it couldn't be happening to us.
I know the anger, and I know exactly what my people are feeling.
We've lost the city. It's gone.
I want to know why God let this happen.
Unity. Empowerment. They're not just cliches. We have to get ourselves together.
Thank you very much for coming on the show. Very much welcome here. And when you watch this documentary, you feel an overwhelming sense of injustice against black people in the US. And another thing that's striking about this documentary is that it's an oral history as told through many different perspectives and angles, through police officers, jurors, and a whole host of others, the victims and families of the victims. And Lee, if I can start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
I think you've sort of identified what makes it unique and what makes it particularly probing is it's an inside story. So the filmmakers, they don't go to pundits and people from the outside. Every single person you hear from was within the story. They're part of the story, whether they're perpetrators or victims or police or, you know, lost loved ones. And that and keeping to that very tight focus, I think, really, I mean, it obviously ups the emotional side of the stories because people are talking about their direct personal involvement, but it gives you that unique perspective because we're not trying to hear from, you know, professors and cultural critics outside it. We stay very much within the story, and I think that's a really great move. The other thing that's great is he doesn't identify who's who. Mm. So you start hearing from people, you might then find that they were a policeman who was, you know, inflicted some violence, or, you know, an African American who was involved in, you know, hurting a white American. And by doing that and saving the sort of the revelation, you get to just hear who these people are before you. Otherwise you might just immediately identify them as, oh, racist police officer, mm-hmm. or, you know, violent African American. And of course what you're hearing is a more sort of multifaceted side to each of these stories, and I think that's a real strength in the film.
That is indeed a great strength, and you hear their personal stories, and I enjoyed that progression, and you feel a connection to all these characters. And Suresh, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Let It Fall?
I think it's a rich history, almost a forensic examination of a decade before the so-called uprisings. I wouldn't call it a riot. I use the word uprising, and there's a reason for it. And I think it tries to focus on what took place, what incidents took place which led to the build-up of the riots, which is very important. The context is very, very important. And even in this country, when there are public disturbances taking place, people only look at one trigger moment that started the stuff, rather than the history of relationship between the black communities and the police, for example.
So you're saying this context, this build-up is very important.
The context is absolutely
important.
Critical. I mean, you know, the police commissioner's views about baton charges, metal baton charges, choke holes, and he tries to describe black people not suffering as much as the white people in terms of that. It's just sheer racism, in my view. It unmasks the real relationship between the authorities and people who live in the area, who took part in it and who survived in it.
Of course, LA was a very iconic city. It still is, but particularly at that time because of the Olympics, and they even had their first black mayor. So who would know, and underneath the surface, that all this racial tensions was bubbling?
Well, I think what he's trying to point out is that it's enmasked it, but actually people who live in it know exactly what's happening, including the police office and the mayor and the police commissioner. So although the story in cinematic terms is being told through different eyes, what is clear is that the bubble and the bubbling and the simmering and of dissent and the relationship souring between different authorities is actually very, very open and pertinent. And people are turning a blind eye to it. For example, you know, the chokehold is being criticized by everyone. It's actually made illegal. So what do the police do? Instead of decreasing their powers, they increase their powers by using a metal baton. And they use both taser and, I mean, youth.
And I'll have to pause you there. We'll go into that detail later on.
Sure. One of the many issues that came up during his time as a chief was the chokehold. It was a controversy for a long, long time in the media.
The Los Angeles Police Commission late today officially reprimanded Police Chief Daryl Gates for comments he made last month about black people and a police restraint method.
Chief Gates said, in some blacks, when it is applied, the veins or arteries do not open up as fast as they do in normal people.
That's asinine. That's insanity. That I still to this day can't believe someone said that. And, of course, that raised a firestorm.
There is a direct parallel between the disproportionate killing of black people in this city and the irresponsible remarks of the chief of police.
There was truly shocking comments made by the LAPD police chief at the time, Daryl Gates. And of course, we learn a bit later on in the documentary that he refused to apologize for those comments. And he gave a sort of apology for people being offended, which is hardly an apology. Lee, what was your reactions watching those comments being made?
Well, I mean, they're horrific. And Daryl Gates, I mean, this area and this time in American history and leading up to the riots, there's been a number of films made on this in the last few years. And so this the film goes over, you know, if you're familiar with those films, a lot of familiar ground. So Daryl Gates has been vilified, very rightly so, a lot of the time. What's very interesting about this film is there's a section towards the end where they show that his son himself was addicted to drugs. And it's not letting him off the hook in any shape or form, but it's giving you another side to this person who is very easy otherwise to just demonize as, you know, the big bad guy. And don't get me wrong, his policies and his, you know, his stance is you know, you can't justify it in any way. But what's really interesting about the film is it tries to sort of look at people from different angles and maybe give facets of them you didn't know about without excusing it. But, you know, you go, okay, well, then this guy has some other issues going on at the time. Now, again,
that
doesn't
is a
excuse
very
it,
complex
but it's
story.
It's really trying to look at things from a wider angle than you maybe have seen in the past.
And, Suresh, would you agree with what Lee said just there? What did you make of these comments being made?
Life is complicated. People are very complicated. I've been in riots in Southall in the 70s, and I know people are complicated. But to justify, I'm not saying Lee is justifying, I don't want to give an air of justification. To me, the comment about the chokehold and not apologizing was sheer racism, and there's no excuse for it. He's a senior police officer. He's a senior police officer who should be held accountable for his comments and his practices and procedures. Yes, he's a human being, but we are beyond that in that environment. So when I live in areas like Southam, which is where I come from, which has had riots, I expect police officers to be totally professional. What I don't expect them to do is to blame the victim or the communities that are victimized by police officers because of their racism. And it's happened not just to black people. I did a case of Blair Beach, who was killed by the SPG in 1979. You know what the police said? He had a thin cranium, that's why he died. Mm. And they used a lead gauge baton to kill him in 1979. Mm. In Mark Duggan's case, what did they say? Honest but mistaken belief. So there's a justification that takes place perpetually by the mainstream and politicians. I do not want to excuse that. Yeah. That doesn't mean, cinematically, people can't look at the complicated picture and come to a resolution. But our society is divided between people who have power and who don't have power.
That's
really important to look at.
And Lee, I want to ask you, in picking up on your point, do you think Ridley was sympathetic in any way to the riots through this film? Do you get the idea that the police are in fact the problem, that the riots or uprisings didn't happen out of a vacuum, that people just became crazy one day?
No, I mean, the whole 10-year time frame, as Suresh has noted, it gives you the context and it gives you a lot of understanding of why tensions within the communities and between the police and not just the African-American community, the Korean-American community, Japanese-American, mm-hmm. It's a very, diverse picture that this film paints. I think Ridley is very... he's an interesting figure because he's kind of known as a bit of a polemicist. Mm-hmm. He wrote a very controversial piece for a magazine about 10 years ago using the N-word and criticizing his own community, mm-hmm. With 12 Years a Slave, which he wrote
he's
the screenplay
the for.
Yeah, him and the director had a big falling out. And I was surprised, actually, at how much empathy this shows. It's not his usual kind of... mode of speaking, if you like. He's very much into controversy usually and stirring things up, and I felt that this was a much more restrained and trying to be more empathetic to look at it. He doesn't let anybody off the hook. So as I said, you don't identify some of the people speaking, and then you find that actually some of these guys were the guys who dragged the white truck driver out of the van and nearly killed him. Mm-hmm. Similarly with the police, you see some people making some very, reasonable statements, and you find out they're absolutely part of the endemic racism of the LA police force. Mm-hmm. So I was very interested at getting that sort of, empathetic thing. And again, without letting anybody off the hook, and, there is clear racism going on there without any shadow of it.
Well, of course, and it's interesting that so many interpretations can come out of this, and I guess that's a testament to the documentary. And Lee, as we heard in the documentary, one of the police officers in charge at the time told his police officers to avoid that area. Mm. Were they effectively then abandoning their duty to protect and serve?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly no expert on police tactics and what you should and shouldn't do, but there was a very clear, decision taken to pull out, and obviously that creates a vacuum, and that allows a lot more things potentially to go on that maybe would be restricted if there was a police presence there. But, this is just part of the chaos. What it does, it really gives you a picture of the absolute chaos that happened within those 2 days. I was actually in LA probably a couple of weeks after these events, and I was actually walking around through South Central LA. I'd never been in a sort of supposedly peaceful community that had such an air of foreboding and tension. And so it was still, just absolutely in the air, really, really unnerving. So I can only imagine what it would have been like on the 2 days in question. Again, that's no excuse not to get the police in there, because that effectively is their job, to try and maintain, some sort of, so that things don't just descend into utter chaos. It obviously had a huge impact on the events of those 2 days.
And Suresh, why didn't the police go to the area? Were you surprised by their reaction? Were they intimidated by the riots?
I wasn't surprised at all by the reaction. It's a very common police practice in a public disturbance to leave an area on its own. Public disturbances and riots raise a number of issues, and one of them is, why is it that law-abiding citizens living in that area destroy their town?
But they have genuine grievances.
I've been involved, as I said, I've participated in public disturbances. The trigger for me has been racists coming in and the police not stopping them, and then the police arresting us on a continuous basis. And
so the victim instead of the perpetrator
that comes. And when you are there, you realize the danger that exists. You realize the chaos that exists. You realize that you live in the area and you're breaking up a shop and that you're fighting with the police. You actually realize it's very conscious. It's not as if it's unconscious and there's God, nobody's in control. It's frightening. And it's only people who participate in it, who want to create a message, actually win the day. So you create those areas where the police can't enter for a specific period, for a specific reason. And that is to say that if we are not hurt, and if after all, even according to, you know, the apostle of peace, Martin Luther King, riots are the voices of the unheard, mm-hmm. which is actually what they are. Yes, you have sterile areas created by the police. In the same way, you have policing of what you call saturation policing, which they talk about in the earlier period, which is indiscriminate arrests at certain times mm. to create fear in community.
It was Project Hammer, I think, they were called it in the documentary, Operation Project mm. Hammer.
Yeah, I mean, in this country, they call it saturation policing. Mm. And we've, in BRICS...
Well, we'll just pause there for now, as John Ridley talking during an ABC radio interview with Amna Nawaz about the prospect of another uprising.
Worry there could be similar kinds of level of riots or uprisings and
absolutely
you think that, yeah
you know look whether how the scope and scale how big they are how yeah. pervasive they are you know again you know Los Angeles is a city how it was policed and I don't even mean, I mean the psychology of it just the numbers the demographics what the capacities were that's very very different it was very very singular so I have no doubt in terms of interactions in terms of what happens in communities, how we look at each other, you know, that we know, I mean, we just know that there are issues, whether that results in a large-scale uprising, whether it results in a few individuals spilling out on the streets, mm-hmm. whether that is a public demonstration where police and citizenry are going out together to say, look, there's an issue and we got to deal with it, or whether it's just people who feel like they're fed up, you know, how it happens, what the results are, that I can't predict, but I'm absolutely sure that there are stress points, that there are people who feel like they're being marginalized, they're not being listened to somewhere right now, and they are going to want recourse. We need to make sure that that recourse is positive, it's real engagement, because otherwise, you know, when you take away people's voices, when you take away their ability to be heard, they will make themselves heard in any way that they feel is appropriate.
Lee, you were just saying earlier how much of an activist Ridley is. What did you make of his comments there in that radio interview?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important. You know, historically, he's done these, you know, he's had these moments where people have been very critical of what he's done. People change. And I think he would probably say that he's not the same filmmaker or maybe even person that he was when he did these other projects. And fair play to him. You know, if we're discussing this particular film, I think it's a really balanced, restrained, empathetic portrait that really tries to get to the, you know, the hub of a wide range of issues. So, you know, I can only kind of agree with everything he's saying. And it's also, I think the other thing is, we hear so much about this one time in LA. I would love to hear similar projects about other cities in the US and also in other countries. It's not just America that has systemic, you know, issues with its police force and racism and stuff. It's happening all over the world. And it would be great if there were, you know, similar projects as detailed and nuanced that covered other areas. I know more about, you know, Rodney King and Natasha Harlins than I do about some of the, you know, the issues that have happened in this country simply because of the proliferation of documentaries and studies about this time. Mm-hmm. It's all important, mm-hmm. but I'd also like to see other areas and other countries covered in a similar way.
That's interesting. Of course, this year marks 25 years since the LA sure. riots. Perhaps this is why all the emergence of these documentaries are coming out. But Suresh, I'd like to ask you, actually, what are some of the differences or similarities between the US and the UK when it comes to institutional police racism and how they treat black people?
Let's look at the similarities. I think the British police has been found to be institutional racism because of the McPherson inquiry in 1999. And there hasn't been enough work done by the police to show that they've actually dealt with it properly. You've seen in this country, just like America, although the proportion of killings in America is much, much, much greater. You have something like 16 deaths a day. Mm. You don't have the same frequency, but it's a smaller black population than America. The American population has been there longer. I think what you really have in similarity is the lack of accountability of the police force, the manner in which police almost get away with murder or police brutality. Nobody's actually held account in a public arena.
Of course, this is why what caused the riots, effectively the straw that broke the camel's back, was that there was videotape evidence of Rodney King's brutal bleeding,
I think
the police officers walked free.
Yeah, they walked free in Rodney King's case as far as the district was concerned. But obviously, as you know, two people were convicted in the federal court in the subsequent trial.
Of course,
and there are important points to make on the judiciary as well in this trial.
The whole criminal justice system.
The differences are that just the Black American political process of being there for a long time, of developing resistance, Black power politics, is much more deep-seated than in this country. But this country has this glass ceiling which does not see pivotal figures in the Black community just as important as the Americans would do in terms of Black. For example, people like Huey Newton in the Black power movement. There are equivalents in this country. And just like this film, there's a film called Hard Stop on Totem Riots, mm-hmm. which is a fascinating, moving film mm-hmm. of the killing of Duggan told through the eyes of his two friends. It's a fascinating film. It could be much better if it was given more finances. Mm-hmm. So there are attempts being made. But I think this country neglects and actually does not acknowledge the skills that Black communities have in their communities, young people, mm-hmm. women, and children.
So there's much work to be done, I suppose. And unfortunately, we're reaching the end of the program now. And Lee, just the final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
I would. I've seen quite a number of the recent films that either touch on this specific area or, you know, institutional racism. And I would say it's one of the more thorough and nuanced films. I would also recommend the Made in America film, which mm-hmm. again covers similar things. But it really is when people actually, it's proper journalism. And it's also good filmmaking. And when you put those together, you know, you really do allow viewers to get a better understanding. And then hopefully that's what you can build on to sort of, you know, change things in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming on to Doc Review. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambayati.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام مثل الحريص على الدنيا مثل دودة القز كلما ازدادت من القز على نفسها لفا كان أبعد لها من الخروج حتى تموت غما.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "The similitude of the one who covets this world is as the caterpillar. The more silk it spins around itself, the harder it makes it exit for itself until it dies of grief."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam supplies some very deep knowledge and some immortal commandments full of high moral standards and ideals to one of his students in a conversation between the two. Speaking with his student Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam tells him certain things in a very long discussion. Just one part of that discussion is as follows. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, "Allah abolishes the stumbles, the mistakes of a person, so that a person can remember and resort to repentance and fear, istighfar and khawf, and this resorting to repentance and fear increases a person's insight and knowledge equal to the amount of fear which is increased in a person. And this is because Allah says, 'Surely those who guard against evil, when a visitation from the Satan afflicts them, they become mindful, and then lo, they see.'" In this very beautiful discussion between Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salam and his student Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi, we find that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us that sometimes when Allah wants us to become closer to Him, He reminds us of the sins and the errors of the past. And now when we are reminded of the sins and the errors of the past, we need to remember that when we feel this kind of sadness, this regret, this shame, this embarrassment, then we must resort to, we must run towards istighfar, repentance, asking forgiveness from Allah, and fear, khawf. Fear of what? Fear of the punishment, fear of being disobedient. This fear and this repentance then opens the doors of knowledge and basira, insight,
in a human being. As the Holy Quran has said in Surah Al-A'raf, verse number 200, again, which was stated by Imam Al-Baqir alayhi salam, that those, first of all, who guard against evil, meaning they are trying to stay good, they are trying to stay away from evil, and then Satan comes and afflicts them with a whisper, which causes them to make a mistake. These people realize that they have made a mistake, and they ask for forgiveness, and then they see, they gain insight, they gain basira, they gain knowledge and wisdom. Beautiful and profound pieces of wisdom in such a small part of a very long dialogue between one of the students of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam by the name of Jabir bin Yazid al-Jufi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam himself. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Just to let you know that when you hear these fatwa from our mujtahideen, you know, people ask this question, oh, mujtahids are giving fatwa, where does it come from? Well, the fatwa in most cases basically are based on the ahadith of the imams of the Ahlul Bayt. Or even if it's not exactly from the wordings of the ahadith, it is based on the principles derived from the Qur'an and the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt. Qatada was silent for a long time, and then he says to him that I have jalastu bayna yad al-fuqaha wa qaddama ibn Abbas. He says, you know, I have sat down in presence of many fuqaha and mujtahideen and scholars, even in the presence of Abdullah bin Abbas, but I never felt so much humbled the way I'm feeling now in your presence. And that's where Imam says, وَيْهَكْ أَتَدْرِي أَيْنَ أَنْتَ O Qatada, you are feeling this way, don't you know where you are sitting? You are sitting بَيْنَ بُيُوتٍ عَظِنَ اللَّهَ أَنْ تُرْفَى وَيُسْكَرَ فِيهَا إِسْمُهُ Imam recited ayat number 36 from Surah Nur, where Allah says that there are certain houses that Allah has allowed those houses to be elevated in esteem, and so that Allah's name may be mentioned in those houses during the mornings and the evenings. And there are people in there who are not distracted by business, and they are there for the zikr of Allah and establish the prayers and giving in charity. Imam says, you are sitting in the presence of those houses. And Qatada said, I never realized that these houses that Allah is mentioning in the Quran did not refer to physical houses. Now I know it means symbolic houses in person of yourself.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.